history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories out there just waiting to be told if we'll take the time to ask a few questions and listen to those answers. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And the story that you're going to hear today is one that couldn't be told for decades. And you hear a lot of veterans who say they couldn't talk about it for decades, but those were personal reasons. This was a legal reason. He would have been in big trouble if he told this story before about a decade ago. We are in Hollister, California, a place that John Cardinale has called home for about 60 years now. But you grew up in Monterey, California, just a few miles away from here on the Central California coast. One of 12 children, a family. Your mother and father are both immigrants from Sicily. So what kind of childhood was that?
That was pretty rough in Sicily. There were children. And they weren't married there. They got married here in the United States where they met. Met in Pittsburgh, California, and they were married and raised a family.
And they kept it even. Six boys, six girls. You are the fourth from the bottom in that group of 12. Can you help me understand what that childhood was like around Monterey? I mean, we've read John Steinbeck stuff. We've heard about, you know, the canneries and all that. Is that the kind of atmosphere you grew up in?
Yes, that was pretty rough those days. We weren't the only family. In fact, all the Italian fishermen, they lived up at what they call Spaghetti Hill, the whole Italian district. All fishermen, they had a rough life, and we had the same thing, rough life. We're very poor. They're all poor. We slept five in a bed at that time, and the houses weren't like today. A boy or a girl had their own rooms, their own bathroom. We had to share one bathroom, and we slept three in the head and two in the feet, and we had a hell of a time.
How young were you when you had to start working and helping out the family in that fashion?
I started selling papers, I think, 10, 11 years old. And I started delivering, and I worked like hell, believe me, as a child. I never took any sports to school because I didn't have time to play. I worked, and every penny I made, it went to the family, helped support them, feed the family. And it was rough those days. We had passed clothes on from one kid to the other, and even went to school with holes in our shoes, and we had to get a piece of cardboard or playing card and place it in the shoulder so water or gravel wouldn't get in our feet. Like I said, we weren't the only family. There's hundreds of Italian people like that, kids. And we go around in the mornings, you get up, night you went to school, go around the play yard and say, "What are you carrying today, John?" "I have ace of spades in my soul." "And what do you got?" "I got the king of clubs," things like that. That was those days. Sure. Today I think about it, I die laughing. Anyway, it was rough, but we're happy.
Yeah, you write about that in your book. So many kids had those playing cards covering holes in the soles of their shoes that you guys could actually have a little card game. Hard for a lot of people today to fathom that. And at home with your parents and those 11 siblings, were you guys speaking English or Italian?
We had to speak Italian. My mother and father could speak English, but not to our kids. My brother and sister all English speaking. You know? And we got along fine, no arguments.
I've got to ask, only because I married into an Italian family and I know how priceless some of those recipes are. Was there a dish that your mother made that you can think about right now and still taste it in your memory?
Let's see, my mother's a great cook. Well, she'd make raviolis twice a year in Easter and Christmas time, but she was a great cook altogether. Chupinos and fish chupino, meat chupino, and stews, whatever. Pizza. Those days, the pizza they called the shawada. I don't know if any Italian people would know the name shawada. Means two layers of pizza, one on top of each other. The layer of dough, and you grate it. Those days, we had anchovies, lots of anchovies. No, we couldn't afford the pepperoni, all that. So we had anchovies. Then another slice of pizza, bread on top of that, and you burn it and put it in your mouth. So high, you know. Anyway, but she was a great cook. Let's see, she baked 12 loaves of bread every other day. We ate 6 loaves a day. And that poor woman was always baking by sacks of flour. And the sacks of flour had stamped on there, remember right, was Sperry flour, I believe. asparagus, probably 100 pound sack of flour. And I bet you we may have used maybe, I don't know, 75 to 100 pounds a week. And that's about it. But it was a good time. We enjoyed it. Never fought among yourselves.
That's saying something when there's 12 kids, not to have fights among those siblings. I know it's a long time ago. I mean, you're 96 years old now. We're going way back. But when you were a boy, do you remember having hopes or dreams or ambitions of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do? These are the adventures I'm going to have? This is the career I'm going to have?
I remember well when I was, I believe, 10, 12 years old. Now, this is kids talk, 10 years old, 12 years old. I told my mother in a time that whenever I get rich or become a rich man, I'm going to buy myself 100 pairs of shoes, 100 pairs of slacks. Now, this is kids talk now, 9, 10 years old, and 100 pairs of shirts, and I'm going to buy you a house. Well, as years went by, and actually grew up and got married and became pretty successful, I did buy her house. In fact, it's still there. Today, I still have 100 pairs of shoes, 100 pairs of slacks. I gave most away because I'm 96. They don't fit me anymore. But anyway, my dream came true, believe it or not. And I live well. I live in Ridgemar Country Club. I'm doing well. And
none of those 100 pairs of shoes have an ace of spades in the sole?
Nothing. These are all brand. I have to laugh. No more ace of spades. The only time I use an ace of spades when I play poker. You know? Uh-huh. The only time I see cards. But outside of that, that was a riot. All the kids had holes in their shoes. Everybody. A school kid, 10, 12, 11 years old. The way of life those days, nobody had any money. Well, most of all. I'd say 99% of those kids my age are all dead. I think I'm one of the last. And I'm one of the few of the last OSS member too, I believe. What I understand.
Well, I think that's right. And we're going to hear that story, and people can read about it in your book, 65 Years of Secrecy, a personal story of an OSS agent during World War II. Some people today don't even know what the OSS was, and you didn't either before World War II. Did you have any sense that war was coming? I mean, you're living here in Monterey, California. There's the big Presidio there. This is a big army spot. But did you have any inkling that something like this was going to happen?
I have no idea war was coming. It was a sudden attack, a surprise attack by Japan, the United States, and I had no idea. It just came out of nowhere.
Do you remember how you heard about it?
I don't remember how I heard. We heard it through the grapevine, or through newspaper, radio, whatever, being attacked and so on and so forth.
Do you remember a sense of panic or fear around Monterey? I mean, that's a coastal spot. Could Japan attack right there?
Well, we were surprised. The reason I say that, because there are a lot of Japanese members in Monterey that had fish markets, abalone boats. They used to dive for abalone. The only abalone boats were run by Japanese fishermen, and we know the Japanese real well, close family, close community. When it broke out, they found this one abalone boat drifting at sea. I guess they thought they sunk it, but I guess it was floating somehow, and the fuel was out of it. Now, this is according to Coast Guard. And we found out it was one of the owners of Monterey Wharf Fish Market. He was a captain, a Navy captain for his Japanese Navy. He was gone. I guess somebody picked him up and took off, thinking the boat would sink, but evidently did not sink. I did not see the boat, but according to the rumors for Coast Guard, they found this boat drifting.
So the implication was, now that Japan had attacked, he was going back to fight for them.
I believe so, yeah. Uh-huh. He had a captain's rating in the Japanese Navy.
And I guess if you don't remember clearly December 7th and those days around there, there's a pretty good reason, because you were kind of smitten. You had this young lady, Josephine, that you were determined to marry so much that 5 days after Pearl Harbor, you guys went to Reno and eloped. Her dad couldn't have been happy about that.
Yeah, we eloped right after Pearl Harbor Day. Pearl Harbor the 7th, I eloped the 12th, I believe, of December. I wanted to wait till later on. I had a few dollars to get married, but I couldn't wait, I guess. And got my wife, we eloped, and she took off with the clothes on her back, and that's it. And I only had $300, $400, $500 saved up, and we took off and used that, bought our clothes. I had rented a house before we left. Went to Pittsburgh, California. I had a friend that had a furniture store. I gave him $100 down. We ordered this, ordered that, and gave him the key to the house, and he had orders to deliver to Monterey, to Pacific Grove, and set the house up, because we were taking off for a week for our honeymoon. And that was it. I got back from Pacific Grove, the house was all set up, and went back to fishing.
And so you were a commercial fisherman at the time with quite a few of your brothers, too?
All my brothers are commercial fishermen, all of them, except one. We're six boys. One, he couldn't take the ocean. He'd vomit all over the place, so he couldn't go fishing. But five of us went fishing, and one had was a partner, one of the purse seiners called the City of Monterey. He's one of the partners there, and I fished for a couple other boats, and the Bibbiné and the Jackie Boy, and those are purse seiners. They're 80-footers. Pack around 140 ton of fish in a hatch. Sardines, I'm talking about. We went off fishing for quite a while. After sardines, about 1950, sardines disappeared from Monterey Bay and the Pacific Coast, in fact. I quit fishing, went to work in town or whatever. Started painting. From then on, painted about 6, 7 years. Became a painting contractor, which I did well. And I moved around here and there, San Jose. And then I settled in Hollister, and I did pretty good in Hollister.
And for all those years, you had a lot of friends, and they all knew that you'd been a fisherman and a painter, but they didn't know much about what you did in World War II because you couldn't talk about it. But if you hadn't been drafted, you think you would have just kept on fishing? Did you have any eyes on the service at all?
I was drafted in 1942. They had put me in Presidio, Monterey. They gave me all kinds of aptitude tests, what I can do with a cavalry or whatever, radio, cook. Anyway, I excelled in radio, and they put me radio, and from there, I think I went to UC Davis for more radio experience and Morse code, that is. And from then on, I transferred to North Carolina, Camp Butner. I was infantry, still infantry. No SS yet, studied radio, and I was pretty good. I believe I was one of the best in the class of radio operators, and I kept moving up until I became an OSS operator.
And I want to hear the story of how that happened, but I'm just thinking about, from a personal standpoint, here you've got this big family you've been so close to for all these years. Now you've got a new wife.
She was pregnant. I was drafted, and we had a son just before when I went overseas. Before that, I was in infantry in North Carolina. I went on maneuvers, the Blue Army and the Red Army, like you see movies, Blue and Red Army with bandanas. And I was an umpire, a radio umpire for this lieutenant in charge and driver we had. So there were three in the vehicle. I was the radio operator for the lieutenant as an umpire. We went around umpiring this and that, went on Blue Army, Red Army. We can go any kitchen, want to eat, whatever, because we're neutral. We went to have supper, one of the fuel kitchens in North Carolina, the hill somewhere, I don't know where it was. And that night we had dysentery. 2 or 3 in the morning, I got up, my driver got up, and the officer got up, and no, no, they had a trench built from here to Kingdom Come. To all squad, the trench. And anyway, me, the lieutenant in charge, and the driver got together and said, we're going to knock this team out. A fighting man can't fight if they had dysentery. And he went to the captain in charge of that battalion there, old major, I forgot what rank he had. We knocked him out. He couldn't fight anymore. Every Saturday, all these armies, blue and the red, got together, big, large tent, and a bunch of high-ranking officers as a judging. And our case came up, and the heads got together, and big wigs, they got together and told that we were right, and the captain was wrong. They're out of the maneuver, so we won our case. As we're leaving that tent, we're back to maneuvering again. I saw a big sign out there posted. I'd say the sign must be 3 by 3 feet or 4 by 4. Anyway, written chalk, and it says, wanted volunteers for OSS, Office of Strategic Services, hazardous duty, has to know radio, speak another language, and a couple other things that they wanted to know. Anyway, so I talked to my officer, and so I said, I'm going to go sign up. I'm going to volunteer. He says, Cardinal, he says, you're crazy. You shouldn't volunteer. You know what you're getting into? I think I do. You're married. You got a child. Anyway, so I signed up. I signed up OSS, and went back to maneuvering. Well, about 3 or 4 hours later, I get a call saying, return back to camp. And anyway, he said, pack your bag, Cardinal, and you're going to Washington, D.C. So whatever I had, and Mary Mother said, we'll get you all new clothing. So I packed whatever I had and went to the bus station and reported Washington, D.C. There was someone at the bus station waiting for me. It was all arranged, and they took me to a branch of the OSS, big warehouse. And anyway, I got in there in the warehouse, and with the driver that picked me up, told me to sit in this room, and the major be with you in a few minutes. He's interviewing someone else in another office. So I waited. As I waited, I'm sort of nosy guy, so I sat back and looked at the four walls and saw a big standing light there and the paperclip on the floor and his wife's picture and broken blinds and a few other things that I noticed. A picture of Roosevelt on the wall there. And after about 15, 20 minutes after I was alone, then he called me and he said, Carl, come here, I'm ready to interview you. So I went to the next office where the major was. So he asked me, while you're sitting there waiting for him, what did you see? I told him about the lamp and the paper clip and the broken blade and the picture on the desk, a cigarette in the ashtray. He said, you know, you're pretty good. You observed everything. I didn't expect that. I figured, what kind of questions are these, you know? And that was part of the test. He says, I didn't even notice a clip on the floor myself. He said, that was the major. He said, you should make a good OSS member. So from then on, I went to camp training as an OSS.
And had you ever heard of the OSS before you saw that sign?
I never heard the OSS at all. Never heard anything about Intelliger or nothing. But anyway, after that, from then on, I knew everything. In fact, I had to put my hand in the Bible, swear to whatever I hear here, the office, not to reveal it outside, or even your family. They stress it, even family. They don't want anybody to know what we're doing. Because really, they said not family or anybody, because those days when the war was going on, we had thousands of German spies, saboteurs in Washington, D.C., all over the country in the United States. And we don't want our names to get around, being an OSS member, because they'd probably go after the family and would either harm or would wanted information or whatever, you know. But anyway, nothing more was said, so that's been secret for many, many years.
So you're not allowed to tell anyone, even family. What'd you tell your wife? What did she think you were doing?
She didn't know anything about it either. She thought I was in the Army. They all thought I was in the infantry there in North Carolina. But I never said a word, even my wife, for many years.
Many, many years. The title of his book is 65 Years of Secrecy. He's 96-year-old John Cardinale of Hollister, California. John was very pleased with the book design and layout that family friend Denise Baker produced for him. And if you'd like to have Mr. Cardinale sign one of those books for you or for a friend, he says you can even call him directly at area code 831-637-7397. I have that number and a link for online ordering for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll learn more about his top secret adventures when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chance to hear a story today that couldn't be told for more than 60 years after World War II. Not until the National Archives declassified a roster of OSS personnel in 2008 could John Cardinale begin to discuss the secret work he had done with the Office of Strategic Services during World War II. Alongside his name on that roster are Hollywood stars Marlena Dietrich and Sterling Hayden, director John Ford, the one and only Julia Child, and four men who would go on to become directors of the CIA, which morphed out of the OSS after the war. But this was so much of a secret in 1943 that Johnny Cardinale couldn't even tell his family back home in Monterey, California, what he was doing. They believed he was in the infantry training to go overseas. And you mentioned family, and I think it's important for people to understand, too, what happened to your family. We've had a lot of folks on this show over the years who were taken up by the Japanese internment, moved from coastal regions or closer to the coast, further inland. A lot of them in Arizona and Arkansas and Idaho, all over the place. Some people don't know that Italians and Germans were rounded up, too, and that includes your parents. What happened to them?
My parents went inland to Robles del Rio.
So because they were in Monterey, right on the coast, they said, we need to move you further inland. So they took them in 25, 30 miles, something like that?
Yeah, away from the coast, away from their home. We lived right on the coast there in Monterey Harbor. And they had to move inland. And my folks didn't know anything about it. But they knew they had to move up. They didn't know what I was doing anyway. But until I found out later, that's the way I pulled a lot of string. I went through hell trying to get them back in, which I finally did.
And it was because they were not American citizens. They'd immigrated from Sicily and hadn't become citizens.
Oh, enemy aliens.
Right, they're enemy aliens, just like the Japanese and some Germans. So they get put into this house further inland with another Italian family. But once you're in the OSS, you found out about that, and what'd you do?
I found out my folks had moved out of their home, and I was kind of teed off. And that's when I went to my superiors in Washington, D.C. I was still in training, was that, and told them that my folks were driven out of their home. And here I was in a highly secretive organization known as OSS. And I don't see why they were driven out. And I'd like to find out if they can have the power to send them back home. And we said, well, let's work like hell to try to get them back. But it took about a month or so after they pulled string and paperwork and whatnot. They went back home. And the other party's still there. And my family, the only one. Well, we went back home. All the rest of the aliens in Monterey, hundreds of them, hundreds of Italian family moved away from the coast. Here, the Cardinal, the first one to get back to home on account of my job, what I was doing, you know.
But they never knew that, your parents?
They never knew why or how they went back home, and all the rest of their paisanos and all that all stuck inland. San Jose, Salinas, they went all over the country. And the Cardinal, they went back to their house. They couldn't figure it out. They couldn't say it because they didn't know what was going on.
So your wife and your infant son are back here in Monterey. You're back in Washington, D.C., training with the OSS. What kinds of things did they teach you to do? What was your understanding of what it was you were going to be doing overseas?
Well, my understanding was work behind enemy lines, because they always told us they were going to work behind enemy lines and do this, do that, learn how to blow bridges, railroad tracks, and munition dumps or whatever. Whatever came to solve or whatever to do, they gave us a job. They shipped me from Washington, D.C. I went to New York and the Washington Harbor. From Washington Harbor, I took a Liberty ship to Maiden End, London, a little village, like Pacific Grove, Monterey. They had a big three-story building, a little mansion or whatever. We had OSS agents, foreign agents. They're all OSS. An OSS building we took over, and radio, everything. Mostly, they're concentrating on radio operating. They made radio instructor on me, so Morse code, radio operator, instructor, and taught the 9 Allied agents, they spoke broken English naturally, how to operate radio, taught them Morse code, and taught them how to read, decipher a message. And anyway, from then on, I had the 9 persons under me, and there was a man and wife, code name was Jack and Jill. I think they're French. Out of the 9, I never knew the names. All I knew the code names. And they don't know me, and my code name was Abner. That was my code name.
And did that ever bother you, that you didn't know people's real names and they didn't know yours?
No, it didn't bother me. It just, as long as they knew who I talked to, as far as their name, you know, Godfrey Team or Max Team, then a woman, agent, her name was Kaja, and I still didn't know her name. She's about 3 years older than me. She's one of the best operators I had as far as code operating. She had about 4 or 5 words a minute, which is pretty fast for a greenhorn. So I was doing 20 at that time, 19 or 20. So
people hear words a minute, they think typing. You're talking Morse code by hand, 20 words a minute of Morse code.
And a word consisted of 5 letters. So I was doing 20 of those 5-letter words a minute. And that's kind of when you're coming in the radio, dots and dashes, you're putting everything down, see? And you're putting the like S would come in, did, I put down S, or did, L, A, dash, dot, dot. So I put down the letters, you know. Then you combine them together, and you can make out the message. And I knew the way the operator worked as far as the Morse code. And it's just like speaking to you. If I knew you and know your voice and all that and hand movement, I know who you were. You don't have to tell me your name. Some of these agents were caught, and the Nazi would take over the radio and all that. And I knew right off the bat that they were captured by the tone, the hitting of the keys, you know. And I knew just like a voice, to me it was like a voice. That's how sharp I was, believe it or not. I'm not bragging, but that's how sharp I was. I was pretty good at that. Know that the foreign agents that took over radio would always start with a message. But I had my agent start out with dit, dit, dit before I put the message. This foreign agent that took over the radio, one of my agents got caught, didn't come out with dit, dit, dit. Right. So that it was a foreign agent. They all came in like that, see. But first 3 hits on your key would be dit, 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 S. That means S. And when the key just started, instead of the S, they just start out the message, and I knew right off. Now that, I can tell by the key movement also.
So I want everyone to understand what you're saying. The people you're training are folks who are then going to be out basically undercover in their home country, but feeding the OSS information. So they're spies in their native countries, and they're transmitting information back to you, and you could tell if you heard Morse code, you knew the rhythm of each one of these people's transmissions. So if it didn't match what you were used to, that was a tell to you, well, that's not really who I think it is, and that person's been captured or exposed.
Yeah, that's what it's really when it, that helped quite a bit by knowing the movement of the keys, the fingers on the telegraph key. Like I said, it helped quite a bit, and then I just kept playing with this guy using my agent's key. We're playing back and forth. He's giving me his information. I gave him false information, so on and so forth. It went on for about a few hours, and we had a move, so I didn't contact him anymore. I knew he was caught. He would drop right in the German bivouac. The Air Force, I guess, goofed up or something. Anyway, that's where they caught these guys. When the Americans overran that area, they had got that one agent who was still alive. He had one ear cut off, and the other agent, they said that they had shot him. So out of the two, one survived, but they were still cut off. So anyway, so we knew he was caught, and they killed him.
And you're talking about how you knew these transmissions so well, you knew who was who. But what kind of information is typically being transmitted when they're sending something back to you or vice versa? What kinds of things were you discussing?
Most of the information they wanted, or we wanted, is how strong they were, how strong we were in that certain area. So either the Germans would attack or we would attack. But all of them needed the strength of their side and the strength of our side and how many heavy weapons, cannons, or whatever. That's the information they wanted. Approximately how many men or how many companies there and all that.
So you were privy to a lot of information that the guys actually fighting those battles were never privy to.
That's right. And we knew a lot. We learned quite a bit through our agents. And I had gone behind enemy lines twice, I remember. The most important was when I took a girl, Kaja. They made a movie, The Bridge at Remagen. R-E-M-A-G-N, Remagen.
Right.
Bridge at
Remagen.
That's the one we dealt with. We got Kaja. They wanted, no, Americans couldn't go forward across the bridge because the Germans wanted to blow it up. If they kept it intact, the Americans go over it and attack Berlin right now. And that's why the Germans wanted to blow it up. They had the piers were loaded with dynamite and all that. Anyway, they wanted, while they're fighting back and forth, the Germans on one side and Allies on the other, they wanted to know how strong they were on the other side, the German. They sent us a message, so I round up Kaja, my best agent, good operator. We got underwear for her, German underwear, German shoes, long wool stockings with holes in them, showed that they're poor, you know. And he got her a German bike, German bottle of water, not like bottled water. We had a regular jar, like fruit jar. That was a bottle of water, a round loaf of bread, hard as a rock. We didn't cut it. It was broken in half.
Yeah.
And I had her bite into the bread two or three times with her teeth because the Germans, the Gestapo, were pretty sharp. They were just as sharp as we are. So in case they had her come across, they would check teeth mark, check this mark, check. They knew everything. Anyway, they checked the sock and all that wool sock. Anyway, we round up clothing for this car. You had to go across the river with me, Rhine River, that one, the bicycle. And we had a couple blanket each, a radio. I had a radio for her, Morse key. And I had a radio myself and a blanket. And she had a bicycle. And I rode her across the Rhine River like 1 in the morning, dark night, 1 in the morning. Our side were all notified. We're coming over. Didn't say who's coming, but we're coming. So don't shoot anybody going across the Rhine River. Okay, they had order not to shoot any. Anyway, we went across about 1:30 in the morning, dark as hell. We reached the other side, on the German side, that's behind the enemy lines. The Rhine River is a border. And I pulled the boat up, a rubber boat, the engineers had furnished the doors. And I pulled it up about, from the little coastline there, maybe 40, 50 feet, pulled it up. And you got some bushes hid behind inside there. I went back to the coast, got branch, kind of wiped off the boat markings of being dragged to where we're staying that night. Anyway, cleaned all that up, and we laid there in the boat together. Blanket was cold. And I told Kaja, I said, listen, comes daylight, I want you to go out there about 100 feet from where I'm staying on your bike, stop, get off the bike, and make out you're fooling around with your bike or something, fiddle around with it, you know, show that it's broken or something, so the other bikes will go by. So if you want the two bikes go by, do not join them. When you see four or five, then you get up, get in your bike, and join them. So a few bikes went by. She's still there fiddling around with her bike. After a bunch came in, four or five or six, I forgot how many they were, and she got on her bike and joined them. Now she's going down toward the Remagen Bridge on enemy side. So the guards, I guess, knew these people going to work or somewhere. They blew a lot of face, you know, and passerby. She had a passport and everything, you know. So they went this and she went that way, more or less. And she got herself a boarding house. She stayed there, and she started sending me messages that she's all right. Okay, so I stayed there that night, watching out what's going on, operating, sending messages back to our lines.
And where were you this whole time?
I was hiding in the boat with the bushes around me so they wouldn't see me from the highway. I was off the highway maybe 30, 40 yards maybe, away from the highway, a lot of German army truck, tank, whatever, going by, troop trucks, and I radioed this back to our side. They were taking it all in. Now, I was there a few days. She took up with a German captain, I think it was, a high officer, anyway. I'll put it this way. She was shacking up with them, okay? That's her job as an agent. That's part of your job, to get information. So, but he was revealing everything to her. He was revealing everything to her. They were staying together in his apartment house somewhere, and I would send it back to her. Our side, Allied side. And finally, they went over across and got over Kaja. She was safe. And that was Kaja's mission. That was her first mission. Kaja, my best operator, I think it was, says paid her a couple, $3,000. I'm not sure. Operation there was very good. We sent her back to our lines way back there. About a month or so later, we get a message. Kaja's killed. And I said, well, how come it happened? Her and some corporal army driver driving a Jeep in a side road and blew up in landmine. Not the main road. Main road was all clear of mines, you know. But the side road, they even said that. Not cleared of any landmine. It went sky high. That poor guy. She was a good operator.
And when you were talking about the Rhine and the Remagen Bridge, and you're hiding out in the bushes, you said for about 3 days?
Something like that. I'm not sure, but quite a few days, you know, until we got all information we needed.
But how nerve-wracking was that? I mean, there's Germans just crawling over the whole area. You had to be afraid that you'd be discovered.
I tell you. I hate to say that, but you know the old saying, you have white shorts? My shorts were white. Anyway, it was scary. I wouldn't know John Wayne, you know, or people like that. You know, you fired an Indian, six go down with one shot. I want to talk about John Wayne. He had applied for OSS. He wanted a captain's rating right off the bat. A captain rating, back because well-known and all that. That was John Wayne. OSS, no, you got to go through the rank like all these other guys that pay like us. He wanted a captain's rating. They wouldn't let him, so he didn't join the OSS. OSS is pretty strict.
On the cover of your book here, 65 Years of Secrecy, I see you crouching down in the forest. You've got your sidearm there on your belt, and you've got a helmet on. Is that a regular Army uniform or those plain clothes? What was your typical dress?
My dress is fatigues. No insignia, no identification. Our missions had to be done right there and then. It didn't go through channels. If it went through channels, it'd take days. We were in Belgium, Holland, Germany, and all that. We couldn't wait for orders. We just had to do it right there and then. That's why a lot of the stuff that had been going on, not even on record. So a lot of the mission there wasn't on record. Huh? In fact, they had a letter from the colonel, from a CEO. It says, Cardinale managed many behind-the-line crossings. Nobody knows that.
Well, they're starting to find out because you're finally allowed to talk about it after more than six decades of silence. On the back cover of this book, 65 Years of Secrecy, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll see windmills along the banks of the Rhine River. When we come back, Mr. Cardinale will explain how a quick glance at those windmills would help him know where to hide out when he was behind enemy lines connecting with a leader of the Dutch underground, and also how he helped that leader, codenamed the Dutchman, to uncover a mole within his ranks. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with John Cardinale of Hollister, California, one of the last living links to the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, predecessor to the CIA. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find some short videos of this 96-year-old showing us some of the unique items he brought home from World War II. The Dutch map with his custom legend indicating positions of the nine secret agents he supervised, the medical kit he carried, what's still in there and what he had to dispose of for safety reasons, and even the OSS Stiletto, a lethal dagger adapted for these secret agents by legendary commando William Fairbairn, and given to John by Fairbairn himself after that famous instructor had cut Cardinale's hand with that very same dagger in training. We heard Mr. Cardinale share how he could recognize the Morse code signature of each one of the agents working under him, and how that helped him realize that an agent had been captured. And that's what happened in December 1944. In his book, 65 Years of Secrecy, he admits to wondering whether that agent's capture prevented the Allies from picking up advance warning of the Germans' last-ditch offensive that would trigger the Battle of the Bulge. He was in Belgium at the time with other OSS personnel.
The Germans being one last charge, they went all out, and it was wintertime. We're together, all boys got together. And once they started coming in, the Germans came from all over, new tank, King Tank, much bigger and stronger than ours. And we had to disperse. We each had radios and whatever we took. One guy went south, northeast. Anyway, but we were in contact. After a few days, I guess the weather broke loose and sunshine, and the Americans started attacking with their planes. The Germans kind of dispersed and whatever, and we got together again, went on our business as agents. From then on, we started moving here and there.
As you said earlier, all these agents that you worked with, you never knew their real names, you just had code names. Tell me about this guy whose code name was the Dutchman, and some of the ways that you two communicated.
The Dutchman, he was underground. He had a bunch of civilians, saboteurs and all. I think they had about 150, 175 men. And he was getting more and more every day from the public. And he radioed OSS, and we got it from headquarters of OSS. I guess they were in Paris, and they did relay the message to him. He wanted, I believe, 200 weapons, guns, machine guns, not single weapons, machine guns, automatic rifles with the bullet clips loaded and all that. And he needed Long John Dunder, because winter, cold. He wanted the rations, medication, and what all. He wanted some cigarettes. And he stressed, I think, I don't know, Lucky Strike, I believe it was. He wanted, they needed smokes. Anyway, so we couldn't airdrop these to him because we didn't know if that was an authentic message that we had gotten. And it happened that I had to go. We needed a couple of agents and myself into across the Rhine River again, another part of the area, behind enemy lines. They had two men there on a mission, but we got together through natural radio with this Dutchman, and he's also told me that he needed weapons and all that. I said, well, I'm becoming across the Rhine River. You would like to meet me there by the windmills there. He said, okay, we'll meet you in the other end. So I told him he'd leave at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning where it's dark. Anyway, me and two agents went across the Rhine River, and we had a flashlight with the head of it taped so you see a spot. And he had one also. So anyway, he was singing from one shore to the other, halfway across the Rhine River. We went to the light, landed there right on the beach, and he come out, him and his lieutenant. There were civilian clothes, and I said, underground. They pulled the boat up. We hid in the windmill, and we stood the boat up in, as if nobody used it, see? And we kind of dried it out through hay there and oars underneath the hay on the floor. First he asked me, where's my equipment? I said, well, I heard about it, but the headquarters said they weren't sure if it was an authentic message or Germany trying to get some weapons. He says, well, so I asked for this. I thought he was going to kill me. He was so damn mad. I don't blame the guy. And anyway, I got acquainted with him. I'll tell him, I'm going to radio back headquarters and tell him to start dropping, that this man needs the equipment right away. His army's getting large enough from 150 to 175. Going about 200 people now. He needed weapons and rations, whatever. And then about a week later or so, they made a drop. He got everything. He thanked me, John. Thank you very much. No, Abner. Thank you very much. And I told him where we were going. So he says, we'll go as far as we can. We'll let your men off, and you come back with him. While going to our destination, that one guy in the army there in the underground, he always asked my men questions. Where are you headed for? What's your destination? This and that. And he wanted information. My agent said, I don't know where we're going. You have to ask our leader. So anyway, he asked me, just as a friendly underground operator. I says, I haven't got my orders yet. I have to wait till I get there. What's your mission? I don't know. We're just going to go on, on. And a bunch of questions. As this guy was there in Dutch underground, they're having problems with dynamite bridges, this and that. They're explosive when haywire, see? A lot of snafu. You understand snafu? And anyway, so I mentioned the Dutchman. I said, you know, I had a guy talk to my men where they're going, what the mission was, their name. And he would talk to me, what was my mission and all that. And we got together one evening talking, the Dutchman and I. And the Dutchman caught on. I guess he put two and two together. This guy must be the guy who's causing all our problems with our explosive. Anyway, next morning, I get up. Well, and that's slipping the floor underground there. And says, where's so-and-so? to kill them. The leader cut his throat. Anyway, after that, everything went smooth. He was a German. He's a spy or whatever, or sympathizer or whatever. I solved this case for him, in other words, because I told him that he was asking my men question and me question. So the leader put two and two together and figured it was him.
And good thing you didn't tell him too much, or it might have cost some of your lives.
Right. So anyway, it worked out okay. From then on, everything went smoothly for the Dutch Under. He got his equipment. He got rid of the informer. We reached the destination. I let my two men go. Well, they were behind Berlin. They went their way, and I went back to the river. So the lieutenant and I went back and helped me with the boat. That's it. I went back to the Rhine River.
And on the back cover of your book is a photo of the Rhine River with windmill after windmill lined up on one end of the shore. And those windmills actually were telling a story that most of us would have no clue what that story was. What was the little code you learned about the windmills and the shape they were in?
The Rhine River had quite a few windmills, because the farmer depended on them for irrigation or whatever. And wherever you saw a windmill with a broken blade or a missing blade, that was called safe home. For anybody that knew it, about that markings of the on the windmill, and notches after you or whoever's after you, run, look for a windmill with a broken blade, get in there and get inside, and the sliding door, and just hide behind that false wall, and you're safe there. And the German would probably look around us, and nobody kept on going. But there was quite a few little windmills, broken blades. So it went down. You may see one, and you maybe go down four or five windmills, find another broken blade.
Did you ever have to do that? Did you ever have to go hide in a windmill and go behind those false walls?
Yeah, I slipped in. I would say maybe three or four of them until we reached our destination. Our destination's quite a long, long way off, yeah.
And just some general questions for you. The whole time you're doing this, did it ever occur to you how dangerous it was, that you could lose your life over there?
Well, it occurred to me many times. But, you're 22 years old, only want action and all that crap, Today, I hear a pin drop and jump like a rabbit. But those days, nothing bothered me. I was scared, don't get me wrong. I was scared to sit, but still, I went through it, thank God.
And what do you think they would have told your wife? I mean, you had a wife and an infant son back home. Had you been killed over there, what would she have found out?
I guess the government. Oh, I said probably write a telegram later on, It kept quiet for a long time, so I can't say when and how they would notify my family if I would have to get killed somewhere. Or probably killed in action, maybe. I don't know. I'm just assuming that. Didn't tell them I was OSS, so the war was still going on. Yeah. Well, another day, when I was in Germany there, way behind enemy lines, I get a call from headquarters. Well, the war in Europe was ending now. Japanese war was still going on. I said, Colonel, report to Washington, D.C. The next transportation out of London or somewhere, come back to Washington, D.C. I was telling myself, what the hell? The war is still going. Be over about a couple of weeks in Europe. So I told my men, radio all of them, agents here and there, whatever, that stand fast until you get another message. I have to go back to Washington, D.C. I went back to Washington, D.C. I couldn't figure out what the hell they wanted, Anyway, they said, Cardinale says, prepare yourself. You're going to CBI at China, Burma, India. I said, hell no, I don't want to go to CBI. I said, I volunteered also. I'm going to volunteer out. Now, hold on, don't get mad and all that. Listen, I'm telling my officer now. So anyway, okay, hold on. Take a 45-day leave furlough. That's a long time, 45 days. So I went back to Monterey, 45 days, and my family didn't know why I came 45-day leave, and the war was still going on. I said I was tired, and they gave me a 45-day leave hurdle. 45 days come by, I get a call saying, stay another 7 days. Then they call me back, John, but now the war ended. He says, come back, we got a job for you. So we're going to put you in charge of war crimes trial. Files and documents, a room full of files and documents. Atrocities, the German general so-and-so, colonel so-and-so. He said, whenever they had the trial, they wrap up and mail it to Nuremberg trial. I was going to take that job, but the war ended, and I said, I want to go home, so I went home.
I mean, when you're home for that long, and the war in Europe's just ended, it's still going in the Pacific, I'm sure your family had a lot of questions for you about what you'd been doing, right?
Yeah, they had questions, and I forgot what I told my guys in the army, this and that, so nothing more was said about it. They asked me how many guys I killed, or what did I do, this and that. I told nobody. I didn't even shout at my rifle. And they took it for granted, I guess, so.
And I asked you about, what if you'd been killed over there? Were there some times or you look back now and you say, that was pretty close? That could have been it for me?
We had some close calls, believe me. We had some close calls. Even when we had to cottage across the Rhine River, a couple of soldiers stopped off the road to relieve themselves. And I was no more than the hedge away from the guy, he could have spotted me. Mm-hmm. It was dark, evidently. So that was some close calls. Yeah, not only that, a couple other times. That's where we took up a forest there. We were hiding there. Job like that, you have to have close calls. And you have to know, they taught you how to eat, OSS. They're very thorough about that. One agent was caught in a restaurant. You know, the Americans would slice their meat with this, you know, with the left hand with a knife and fork and change hands and put the fork back to the left hand and cut the meat. There were two Gestapo agents against the wall watching this restaurant, you know, they all dead Gestapo agents. And they saw this guy eating this and cutting the meat that way and changing hands. The fork to his right hand, eating, then put the fork back to your left hand. Now, European style, you cut your meat and you eat with your left hand, see? You never change hands, see? They taught us how to eat. And taught us how to smoke the European way, everything European way.
They taught you how to blend in, but I'm just trying to imagine being in your shoes, and there had to just be a constant fear of being discovered.
All the time, believe me, all the time. You had to look behind your back or this and that. Well, you never know, because those Gestapo agents, they're sharper than we were. They knew everything, every trade, everything, every trick there was, so you had to be careful. I came out of it all right, lucked out, I guess. Not smart, I just lucked out.
Did you ever rehearse in your mind what you would do if you got captured?
I was given a medical bag and two cyanide tablets in case I would capture in a bad position, all that. Take a cyanide tablet, you're out. You're dead.
And you were prepared to kill yourself if it came to that?
Yeah, right. Depends on the condition at the time, you know. But after the war was over, I got him. I took him away.
I was just looking at a framed newspaper article about you and this story, and the quote it had there was you saying that the OSS saved thousands and thousands of lives. How can you make that statement? What does that mean? How do you know that?
Well, I say thousands and thousands of lives, which is true. I give credit to the agents behind the enemy line. They gave all the important information. The strength of the enemy, position the big guns were at, that's all sent in by OSS. Also, I believe that Normandy landing, OSS has something to do with the landing because of many OSS agents on French side, and they more or less gave the information when to strike. The reason they saved a lot of lives, thousands of lives, is on account of the agents' information passed on to our allies. That's my version, saved thousands of lives. Not only military, but also a lot of civilian lives.
When it comes to your time in the OSS, what would you say that you're most proud of?
I don't know. It's hard to say, Paul. There's a lot of things. Stuff I went through and what I did right. They gave me credit for that. I'm only one out of millions of military boys, and not just one of them. I don't know. I just thought I gave my share and help the savings of our country and people.
And when you're in one of those situations like you described along the banks of the Rhine, hiding out in the bushes, hoping that those Germans who were, you know, a stone's throw away don't discover you, what goes through your mind? I mean, I imagine that probably feels like forever until you move on from there, but are you sitting there just closing your eyes and bracing for that moment they find you? Are you saying a prayer that they don't? What are you doing in situations like that?
It's hard to say, Paul. Thinking a lot. I thought about this, thought about that, and in the meantime, I kept looking behind my back, but it was scary. I was really scared many, many times. They're all scared, no matter who you are. They're all scared. You live from day to day. There's always something new every day, and I felt sorry for all these kids that got killed. Thank God I pulled through it, and I came out of my right senses.
You mentioned all the kids who got killed. Over 400,000 Americans died in World War II. Were any of those people that you knew?
Yeah, a couple of guys that were drafted with me in Monterey years ago in 1942. One was killed in the islands. A sniper got him, marched in the jungle there. And another guy hit a landmine. And I don't know, two that I know, real close friends. And I had a close friend, OSS, went through hell together to OSS in Europe. And here he comes back to state, discharging on. And he has heart attack at the golf course. Imagine that. Going through the war, WW2, and come home to a year later or 6 months later, after he discharged, had a heart attack at a golf course, playing golf. That's it. I still thank God for what I've done and being alive at 96 years old. So you never know how much longer I've got. I know I'm one of the few left.
How hard was it for all those years? I mean, your book is called 65 Years of Secrecy. That's a long time. How often over the course of those 65 years did you wish you could have told someone? Did you want to be able to talk about what you did?
I was dying to tell some, especially close friends, my buddies of mine, playing golf and all that here in Monterey, fishermen, where I was a painting contractor, an employer, and never told my men anything. I just as an employer, you know. I was just dying to tell them, but I held up, thank God, and nobody knew until 2008. Then it went public by the National Archives, and that's it.
Yeah, so the National Archives releases this. All the names of people who worked worked with the OSS. Some of those are famous names, movie stars, famous chefs, politicians, Supreme Court justices, and Johnny Cardinale. He's right there on the list. So was that a relief for you when that happened?
It was a relief. Boy, sure, it's just like letting out gas. That was quite a relief. Anyway, it was quite a decent. I was proud of myself for what I did, and a lot of people wouldn't believe it. Like I say, there's only a few left. You probably count them with your fingers on your hand. That's how many's left. Don't know what else to say.
Well, I know what I haven't said yet. I haven't said thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for telling us this story that you had to keep to yourself for so many, many years. What do you think people today need to know about the OSS and what all of you guys were risking your lives to do?
That the OSS did quite a bit for this world, for this war, and it hasn't been publicized too much, which it should. Just as popular as FBI today or the CIA today, but OSS started it all, and they should give OSS credit for all they've done. And OSS put a lot of stuff in the market for public, which they're using today. I remember now when war was going on, the OSS scientists made a hand grenade. The hand grenades we had then, like they say pineapple and all, looked like a pineapple, pull a pin on them, but made a like a baseball, like a hardball baseball the players were using. For the kids today, they can throw a ball perfect, wherever they want. The hand grenade, they had to lob it. And you get a baseball kid today, he can hit that stop sign with the ball. That's how I create. So I don't think it was used much. I don't know if it was used at all, but they made out of handball. A lot of things, like the pipe, gun, and pen, speaker, and all that. They made a lot of that stuff. It all came out of OSS laboratory.
All the gadgets like we see in a James Bond movie.
That's it. A lot of gadgets made by the OSS. That's why they should give OSS lots of credit.
And if you'd like to see a photo of that baseball-shaped Beano grenade and other gadgets developed by the OSS, I have a link for you at hometownheroesradio.com. That link for his book, 65 Years of Secrecy, is there too. And also the 30-minute documentary about his story put together by his nephew, Joe Cardinale, and wife Marilyn for Gavilan College in Gilroy. There is at least one more adventure waiting for this nonagenarian who kept those secrets for so many years. He's already gotten to take a sentimental journey to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Bay Area and visit the National World War II Memorial and other sites, but he's hoping to go back to our nation's capital in the fall when Congress will mark the 75th anniversary of the founding of the OSS by presenting the Congressional Gold Medal to Mr. Cardinale and other surviving veterans who carried out that secret and dangerous duty. So keep your eye out for his signature smile when the news coverage of that big honor rolls around, and join us again next time on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.